The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled How the Hillbillies Remade America by Max Frazier. On April 29, 1954, a cross-section of Cincinnati's municipal bureaucracy, joined by dozens of representatives drawn from local employers, private charities, the religious community, and other corners of the city establishment, gathered at the behest of the mayor's office to discuss a new problem confronting the city, or rather, about 50,000 new problems, give or take. That was roughly the number of Cincinnati residents who had recently migrated to the city from the poorer parts of southern Appalachia. The teachers, police officials, social workers, hiring department personnel, and others who gathered that day in April had simply run out of ideas about what to do about them. Education does not have importance to these people as it does to us, observed one schoolteacher. They work for a day or two, and then you see them no more, grumbled an employer. Some don't want modern facilities. If they have a bathtub, they don't use it, another meeting attendee claimed. And the charges they leveled only descended from there. They let their children run wild. They left their trash in the street and refused to go to the doctor. They misspent what little money they had. They fought and drank with abandon. Some were even rumored to disregard laws here, such as it being a felony to have sexual relations with a member of their own family or with a girl who consents. Marshall Bragdon, the long-serving executive director of an advisory commission to the municipal government known as the Mayor's Friendly Relations Committee, had conceived of this day-long workshop on the Southern Mountaineer in Cincinnati as the gathering was billed. Though he did not like what he heard, he was hardly surprised. A key objective of the workshop, Bragdon would explain, was to de-stereotype the city man's and urban agencies' views of and attitudes toward the hill folks, so that they might be better able to assist this growing population of poor rural newcomers to the city. As the litany of complaints poured forth during the workshop's opening bull session, it was clear that there was much de-stereotyping to do. The 1954 Cincinnati workshop is a little-known episode in 20th century American history, yet it would prove to be extraordinarily consequential. In its aftermath, municipal coalitions in a host of Midwestern cities that were likewise on the receiving end of an influx of white migrants from the Appalachian South were inspired to take similar action. The workshop introduced new and influential ways of thinking about poverty in the post-war city, which would circulate broadly within liberal policy-making circles, and before long would even come to shape the development of Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society. At the same time, the Cincinnati workshop also revealed a yawning cultural divide separating the middle-class professionals in attendance from their white working-class objects of their reform-minded concern, one that was replicated throughout the region and in Washington, and that would only grow deeper and wider over the decades to come. Although none of the workshop participants was overheard talking about a basket of deplorables, the residents, between their descriptions of their new hillbilly neighbors and that more recent political malapropism, which might have cost Hillary Clinton the 2016 election, is unmistakable. Then, as now, liberalism found itself confronting a white working-class problem, at least partially, of its own creation. The sequence of events set in motion by the 1954 workshop offers important insights into our current political impasse and into the lessons of the modern Democratic Party has failed to learn for more than half a century. In the two decades that followed World War II, when the great 20th century migrations out of the rural South were at their zenith, the hillbilly ghetto appeared as a suddenly ubiquitous and more problematic feature on the landscape of the urban Midwest. In neighborhoods such as Over the Rhine and Lower Price Hill in Cincinnati, Uptown in Chicago, Stringtown in Indianapolis, Briggs and the Cass Corridor in Detroit, and in similar neighborhoods in smaller cities and towns across the region, growing clusters of poor southern white newcomers alarmed longer-term residents and amplified concerns about an onrushing crisis of the American inner city. Residents of these hillbilly ghettos, as they were commonly referred to by public officials and in media accounts at the time, stood out for their rural mannerisms and regionally alien cultural markings for being, as Cincinnati Director of Health Education put it, different. Different in speech, in dress, in culture, in habits and mores, in education, in social status, in work experience, and in health. The neighbors themselves, meanwhile, were marked by rates of unemployment, housing insecurity, poverty-related medical issues, and crime and policing that more closely resembled predominantly black urban neighborhoods such as Avondale, Paradise Valley, and Bronzeville than the post-war era's growing middle-class suburbs. The inhabitants of the hillbilly ghetto were white. That they were white confounded many of their mid-century contemporaries who struggled to reconcile them with their more familiar bigotries. The so-called hillbillies, who now constitute a major slum population in several Midwestern cities, are about the only sizable group of white Protestant old-line Americans who are now living in city slums, opined a columnist for Fortune. The trouble with the latter, as with the rural Negroes, Puerto Ricans, and Mexicans, is that they simply don't know how to live in cities. Marshall Bragdon may have felt more sympathetic to Cincinnati's Appalachian migrants, but otherwise he largely agreed with that assessment. The 1954 workshop was intended to focus the city's attention on what Bragdon called the struggle for urban adjustment, which, as he saw it, had left Cincinnati's rural newcomers ill-prepared to succeed in the industrial city. Believing that most city agencies don't know how to help the migrants, Bragdon invited Roscoe Griffin, a sociologist based at Berea College in Kentucky, to help set the workshop attendees straight. In his talk, Griffin explained that the pathological quality of the city's hillbilly ghettos could be attributed to a series of culturally determined patterns of behavior which the southern mountaineers bring with them when they come to live north of the Ohio River, among them a low regard for formal education, an indistinctual emphasis on fulfilling immediate needs and desires, a clannish hostility toward outsiders, and a fatalistic resignation to present conditions. These behaviors, Griffin noted, had originated as natural and even rational adaptations of their impoverished rural circumstances, but they became counterproductive and self-defeating when such people came to live around Liberty and Sycamore streets of Cincinnati. The solution Bragdon and Griffin counseled the assembled city representatives was time, understanding, and above all, patient instruction in the expectations of modern urban society. The basis of all human relations work with all people, Griffin reminded his audience, is that you have first to accept them as they are before they are willing to modify their behavior. The workshop proved to be a hit. The Cincinnati residents in attendance appreciated their new insights into the root causes of hillbilly pathology and were further gratified to be reassured that it was the migrants' behavior and not the city itself that was in need of modification. News of the workshop spread quickly through networks of municipal officials, and soon copycat workshops were being staged in other cities across the nation, many featuring Roscoe Griffin as an invited speaker. Urban adjustment, meanwhile, became the prevailing paradigm for addressing the overlapping issues of migration, poverty, and inner-city decline. In 1957, Chicago created a Committee on New Residents, the first public body of its kind in the country, based on a recognition of the adjustment problems represented by the migration to Chicago of Southern whites, Negroes, Puerto Ricans, and American Indians seeking increased economic opportunity, end quote. Detroit followed suit with its own Committee on Urban Adjustment shortly thereafter, and designed to try to change some of the values, attitudes, and behavioral problems of the existing and continual arriving members of the rural lower class. The Ford Foundation picked up on the urban adjustment framework as well. Ford was then at the leading edge of the behavioral revolution in mid-century social science research, and Bragdon and Griffin's focus on more psychological and attitudinal ramifications of rural to urban migration struck a chord. Ford would agree to fund an expanded version of the Cincinnati workshop at Griffin's home institution of Berea College in the summer of 1958, which brought representatives from seven Midwestern cities down to Kentucky for 3 weeks to study the mountaineer migrants in their native habitat. The Berea workshop became, in the words of Ford's director of public affairs, Paul Vizsaker, the very real entry point for the foundation's growing programmatic engagement with a complex of issues surrounding community disorganization and the unfolding urban crisis. The Berea workshop was restaged annually for the next 9 years, during which time delegates from more than two dozen cities would attend. Subsequent initiatives spearheaded by Vizsaker's public affairs division at the beginning of the 1960s, such as the Great Cities School Improvement Program and the Gray Areas Program, would funnel tens of millions in foundation offers toward a variety of municipal efforts aimed at largely citifying the in-migrant population clustered in the country's declining urban core. I had the sense that we were dealing with people problems, not brick and mortar, and not power structure problems so much, and that we were witnessing the vast migration into the central city. And I shifted at that point to a concern with the migrant flows and what could be done about that. Vizsaker would reflect in a later interview, Appalachia gave us a chance to touch off the concern with the whole process. By the time Vizsaker was tapped to sit on the White House's Task Force on Poverty, convened in early 1964 to begin drafting the legislative foundations of a massive federal campaign to eliminate poverty, it was undeniable just how far and wide the ideas first introduced a decade earlier in Cincinnati had resonated. Vizsaker's Gray Areas Program, with its spatial focus on inner-city ghettos populated overwhelmingly by poor rural migrants, and its programmatic emphasis on replacing deficient migrant cultures with more efficacious forms of community action, was the clearest prototype for what became the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964, signed into law by Johnson that August. A lot of the ideas that ended up in the legislation, noted William Capron, who worked on the task force with Vizsaker and oversaw domestic spending in Johnson's Bureau of the Budget, really were developed out of the Ford experience. As likely as it might have seemed, when Bragdon first convened his skeptical colleagues in the spring of 1954, the hillbilly ghetto had helped set in motion a series of events that culminated in the enactment of one of post-war liberalism's most ambitious social policy experiments. There were always other ways to think about the issue of urban adjustment, of course. Southern Appalachian migrants in Cincinnati, like other groups of rural migrants and low-income residents in the city, were also contending with limited employment options, predatory slumlords, and overcrowded and under-resourced public schools, not to mention an openly hostile police force, which by the middle of the 1950s was arresting white Appalachian natives at roughly four times the rate they appeared in the city's general population. In Uptown, as the Chicago Daily News described it as Appalachia in Chicago, more than one in four apartments lacked adequate plumbing, and residential overcrowding was exceeded only in the poor black neighborhood of Lawndale. By the time the Johnson administration was rolling out the war on poverty, fewer than half of Uptown's adult residents were able to secure full-time work. Instead of recognizing the already accelerating flight of jobs and tax revenues to the suburbs as an early preview of larger-scale disruptions to come, officials used urban adjustment as a rationale for blaming rural poor people for their inability to adapt. In this way, urban adjustment also anticipated the notion of a separate and self-perpetuating culture of poverty, First introduced by the anthropologist Oscar Lewis in 1959, and then widely popularized by the journalist and social critic Michael Harrington over the next few years. Lewis developed his influential theory in ethnographic studies of poor families from Mexico and Puerto Rico, but the catalog of pathological behaviors and attitudes that he identified among his subjects, a strong feeling of marginality, of helplessness, of dependence and inferiority, a lack of impulse control, a strong present-time orientation with relatively little ability to defer gratification and plan for the future, a sense of resignation and fatalism, in many cases directly echoed Griffin's portrayal of the maladjusted migrants from Appalachia. Before long, a distorted and punitive version of Lewis's ideas would win both liberal and conservative adherents and find its way into the very center of post-war social policy, first as a means of explaining why certain groups of people became dependent on social assistance, and then as an argument for curtailing or altogether eliminating those very forms of public support, as it did the urban adjustment framework's earlier focus on cultural habits of the rural poor, broadly defined, gave way to the culture of poverty's near singular association with the more and more distressed black inner city. The consequences of that shift would reverberate to the present. For poor black communities, the racialized discourse around poverty would be an unmitigated disaster. The slow death of federal poverty reduction programs begun under Richard Nixon, the massive expansion of a racially targeted war on urban street crime during the 70s and 80s, and culminating assault on welfare as we know it during the Clinton years would all be executed under the logic of eradicating a culture of poverty that was said to be the defining hallmark of a new black underclass. As a final consequence of all this, the white poor and working classes would come to occupy a more marginal position in the worldview of democratic liberalism over the subsequent decades. After playing a crucial role in catalyzing liberal attention to the social effects of the post-war urban crisis, the hillbilly ghettos of the urban Midwest largely disappeared from view after the formal launch of the War on Poverty. Meanwhile, as deindustrialization, automation, offshoring, and new waves of import competition brought ever-widening devastation to the blue-collar workforce of the country's industrial heartland, professional class interest elevated by the new knowledge and service economy moved to the center of the Democratic Party's agenda. These new Democrats offered the occasional promise to retrain out-of-work miners and factory hands as computer programmers, but in downwardly mobile white working class communities throughout the region, precious little would come of it. Instead, right-wing politicians from Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump would find a rich soil in which to plant the seeds of populist resentment, creating one of the more consequential class realignments in modern American political history. Rightly or wrongly, Hillary Clinton seemed more interested in modifying the behavior of these voters than in trying to understand the material foundations of their grievances. When about a quarter of white working-class Obama voters forsook Clinton for Trump in that fall's election, it was hard not to attribute the results, at least in part, to Clinton's failure to convince that portion of the electorate that the party had anything to offer them beyond condescending disregard. If anybody seems to have learned the lessons of Clinton's faux pas, it is Joe Biden. Since entering the White House, Biden has done more than any Democratic president in the past 75 years to reinvigorate American industrial policy, all while steering its focus toward those parts of the Midwest and South that suffered the effects of deindustrialization most acutely and where the Republican Party has made the most gains among working-class voters. Might this be enough to overcome liberalism's decade of pathologicalizing poor and working-class whites? Recent polling suggests that Biden faces an uphill battle among these voters in crucial Midwestern swing states. But to paraphrase Roscoe Griffin, a party has to first understand where it's gone wrong before it will be willing to change its behavior. For our second article, The U.S. government UFO cover-up is real, but it's not what you think. By Garrett M. Graff. There aren't many secrets that John Brennan doesn't know. He spent 25 years in the CIA, became the White House Homeland Security Advisor, and then returned to the CIA as its director. If a question interested him, he could have commanded legions of analysts, officers, surveillance networks, and tools to find the answer. Yet in a December 2020 interview with the economist Tyler Cohen, Brennan admitted, somewhat torturously, that he was flummoxed by the wave of recent reporting about UFOs. Some of the phenomena we're going to be seeing continue to be unexplained and might, in fact, be some type of phenomenon that is the result of something we don't yet understand, and it could involve some type of activity that some say constitutes a different form of life. That roundabout and convoluted comment piqued my interest. Anything that puzzled Brennan was worth looking into. For the next 2 years, I dove into the history of the U.S. government's involvement in UFOs as part of writing my new book. And along the way, I've become convinced that a cover-up is real. It's just not the one you think. Plenty of revelations, declassified documents, and public reports suggest active ongoing deception. Even today, the government is surely hiding information about its knowledge and working theories about what exists in the skies above. But the cover-up that I believe exists is far more mundane than concealing intelligence that would forever alter our understanding of ourselves and our universe. There are some basic, obvious reasons why the government is withholding knowledge about what are now called unidentified anomalous phenomena, or UAPs. Some public UAP reports are likely the government's secret projects, technologies, and operations. According to the CIA, test and development flights in the U.S. of the U-2 and Oxcart spy planes accounted for more than half of all UFO reports during the late 1950s. The military has more secret test flights, development projects, and special craft than most people realize. Other reported UFO sightings are advanced technologies from foreign adversaries such as Russia, China, and Iran being tested against U.S. defenses. The government doesn't want to give away what's been detected and what hasn't. Rare announcements from officials confirm this, such as when the Pentagon said at a congressional hearing in 2022 that what first appeared to be out-of-this-world glowing triangle-shaped crafts were actually just terrestrial drones photographed through night vision lenses. Plenty of strange incidents, like a mysterious swarm of objects that harassed Navy ships off the coast of California in 2019, indicate that there's a lot more to say about foreign programs being tested against U.S. defenses. Perhaps certain agencies are silent on these programs because they don't have enough information. The government is a maze of operations, classified efforts, and so-called special access programs that make up the defense, homeland security, and intelligence world. No single entity or bureaucrat has a full understanding of what the others are doing, leading to repeated confusion about whether a UFO or UAP sighting is genuine. In 1947, after a civilian pilot reported a strange encounter in the Pacific Northwest that sparked a national fascination with flying saucer sightings, FBI executives became convinced that these peculiar crafts were a secret military program. A more tragic incident occurred the following year when Air Force Captain Thomas Mantell was dispatched to pursue a UFO reported to be to the Kentucky State Police. He died racing after it, crashing on a farm along the Tennessee border. Military officials were perplexed. Did a UFO down a U.S. fighter pilot? The answer remained unknown until the 1950s when the Air Force's UFO hunting unit, Project Blue Book, pieced together that the UFO Mantell chased was actually a secret Navy research balloon under development by a defense contractor. Decades of declassified memos, internal reports, and study projects create the sense that the government doesn't have satisfying answers for the most perplexing sightings. Although many UFO sightings were either errors of human mind or senses, or conventional aerial objects, it said, it couldn't explain all of them. Some sightings were just too weird to rule on one way or another. Proof of non-existence is equally impossible to obtain unless a reasonable and convincing explanation is determined for each incident. Subsequent attempts to solve the mystery have consistently come up short. In 1953, the CIA, with its director and head of scientific intelligence, both bewildered by ongoing UFO reports, convened the Robertson Panel, a secret research group chaired by Caltech physicist Howard P. Robertson. After hearing from experts and examining sighting reports, the panel concluded that there was no evidence that UFOs posed a threat to national security. But it used a sleight of hand to arrive at that conclusion. The researchers looked closely at only a small number of sightings, decided they seemed mundane, and extrapolated that the rest probably weren't very interesting either. The Robertson panel couldn't explain all UFO sightings in the end. It just reckoned that, whatever they weren't threatening. Many people who study UFOs end up frustrated by the government's ignorance rather than its secrets. J. Allen Hynek, a distinguished Ohio astronomer who was involved with research projects, came to believe that government agencies tried to dodge questions about UFOs, not because they were hiding something, but because they had no actual knowledge to hide. For decades, Hynek traveled to UFO sightings around the country. He became so professionally fascinated with them that he wrote several books on the topic, coining the phrase "close encounters of the third kind" and playing a bit part in the Steven Spielberg movie of the same name. He was a constant presence in the government's UFO work from the 1940s to the 1970s. Along the way, he was repeatedly frustrated by the poor answers military colleagues and higher-ups used to brush away sightings, explanations he doubted as a scientist, and ones that didn't square with witness testimonies. After leaving government and founding the Independent Center for UFO Studies, Hynek said he doubted that there was a grand government conspiracy. There are two kinds of government cover-ups, he explained in 1977. You can cover up knowledge, and you can cover up ignorance. I think there was much more of the latter than the former. Many, perhaps most or nearly all, UAP sightings have conceivable explanations, classified projects, adversarial technology, sky trash, but there are almost certainly some world-changing revelations hidden among reports, even if none of them turn out to be visiting aliens. Investigating them could lead to new discoveries in meteorology, astronomy, atmospheric science, and physics. Hynek's words about the government's cluelessness hint at a more intriguing truth. There is something, or more likely, many things out there, and none of us yet know what. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.